Good morning. Welcome to Dig in the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week we're going to talk about, well, all things garden and tomatoes. My guest is farmer Fred Johnson, who has a farm in Nacelle. And
good morning, Ann.
Yes, good morning. So we are at the beginning of the warmest March on record. Astoria had the warmest winter the last 3 months, so December, January, February on record. Astoria did.
It's pretty crazy.
And so it doesn't really, I mean, I think of March as this constant rain, cold, too cold to do anything really outside. The soil is soggy, wet, especially if you have clay.
Yeah.
And people just forget it. We're not. But this year, I mean, I have gotten almost all the weeding in my whole yard done because every time it's sunny, I think, oh, I'll spend a half an hour. And then I've actually gone back and gone to bed and go, well, there's nothing to do here. And go to, you know, so if a person wants to get ahead of the weeds, they can certainly. And if they haven't been weeding, the weeds are already going to seed. So the sooner the better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very unusual springtime.
Right.
And I've been cautioned by a number of friends, you know, to not just go full blast into this because, you know, well, like the morning this morning, it was pretty frosty.
Yes. Well, I think it was 31 in Astoria, maybe even cooler in Nacelle.
And that's going to be tough on all our blossoming plums and cherries.
Which are all happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
I even have my peach tree is starting to bloom.
Yikes.
I know. Okay. So I know that when the weather's like this, people will sometimes get nutso and think they're going to put vegetables in their garden or they're going to try to plant seeds.
No, it's too early. You've got to look at soil temperatures. It's that one thing I've been learning from more experienced farmers than I that unless your soil temperatures are cresting around 60 plus degrees, I mean, and you know, you can measure your temperatures
easily,
but you don't have the bacterial action, you know, the whole microbial action, the whole biota of the soil, it's still asleep, essentially. So unless you've got those soil temperatures really consistently coming up,
okay,
then it's too dang early. You know, especially outside planting. I've been very tempted. Like, I'm planting greens, first of the season greens, spinach, arugula. Some of the tougher mustards are much more resilient in these cold mornings. They won't just die.
But you're not doing them outside.
But I'm doing it in the greenhouse.
You're not putting anything outside, right?
Not yet. I mean, it's time to start the tomatoes and all the hothouse stuff. I'm starting, you know, with all the tomato starts. Now, I was really tempted to start in February, but I've learned by experience that it's, you know, you don't really get any further. And it's very interesting, the whole dynamics of the plant. You know, you start too early, and then the plant just sort of, it's
like waiting to catch up?
It's sort of like, yeah, it's just, you're kind of just sitting around waiting to, it needs to get out into that greenhouse. And generally, you're not going to be able to put them out into your greenhouses until mid-April-ish. Until you've got a consistent overnight temperature above 50 degrees, tomatoes don't like it. They get real crabby if you put them outside and it goes below, you know, if it's hovering there around 50 degrees. Mm-hmm. It's basically just asking for them to, I'm pretty confident it's opening them up to diseases and just all the perils of it's like running around outside when you're got a wet head and no coat. You know, you don't want to do that to your tomatoes there.
Okay, so if people want to, and I've done this for lots of years, you know, to get the kind of seeds that grow good tomatoes for whatever your conditions are, whether they're outside or in a greenhouse or under a cloche or whatever, and start the seeds in the house, right? Have warming mats and have lights and do the whole grow them and pot them up and pot them up and pot them up and then hope that sometime in not too far distant future it'll be warm enough to put them out somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's that whole thing of capturing the season, you know, because once it does warm up, I mean, the season extension is a, a, a huge thing with us here in our climate, mm-hmm. of getting the jump on things, starting them in a warm, nurturing place,
mm-hmm.
when it's crappy outside, mm-hmm. essentially, and then moving them out when the conditions are right,
mm-hmm.
and so that you just play by ear.
You said soil no colder than 50. Right.
Ambient temperatures.
This is
something there's a lot of materials out there, mm-hmm. telling you how to do things, mm-hmm. and it can be very confusing. So it's like you kind of take in a lot of information and then you take it to the laboratory of your own experiments and mm-hmm. then you find out what works for you or mm-hmm. what has worked in your environment, what hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
With our little microclimates, those types of things, it's just an incredibly complex array of variables that you have to contend with. So you're working to try to find that happy medium that gives you a consistent success. At least that's what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
which it entails a lot of failure and screwing up. But then, you've got success in learning from that.
Right. And then you can repeat your successes. And that's one reason to keep a journal of your garden so you know this particular tomato was a bust. So that next year you don't grow it again and go, oh,
yep.
God, I forgot that was such a bust.
Or you just keep it in your greenhouse, in your warm, happy place until conditions are right for it outside.
Okay, but what if a person doesn't have a greenhouse?
For tomatoes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be problematic. Our climate,
Barry got bold last year and had this, we had way too many tomato plants, which we always do, and he put one in one of the new raised beds, and it had, it has a covering on it,
mm-hmm.
Some of the time. Anyway, that thing produced as well as the ones in the greenhouse, but it wasn't, it wasn't covered during the hot part of, the nice part of the summer. It wasn't covered at all. So it was just outside. It produced until Thanksgiving. And
nice.
And I was thinking, and it's cherry, so there's a little teeny.
Yeah, there's a case of that, is that your experiment and you kind of, find something that works for you.
Right. Well, and I'm feeling like I'd like to be a little more bold with some outside tomatoes because I like the taste of that growing in soil with, watering it in a regular way rather than the big pots or the little pots or the stupid pots
or the
in the
greenhouse. Yeah, there's some hubbub in the old planting world about the difference in flavor of a field tomato as opposed to a greenhouse tomato.
It's not the same.
It's, and it's interesting that some of the theories on that is that you with a greenhouse plastic, you deflect some of the infrared light spectrum.
We don't have plastic. It's all glass.
Well, that's what. I don't know.
Oh, the thinking is it's the kind of light you get in.
That it may block block some
of
the infrared.
Glass blocks some as well.
Yeah, you're not going to get 100% transmission.
Right.
So
that affects the flavor.
There's people out there that say that they can tell the taste, they can differentiate the taste between a field tomato.
Wow.
Which you can get away with, say, in Yakima. I mean, right now, but they're, in Yakima, they're definitely starting all their starts in greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be, when the conditions are warm up enough, they'll be transplanting them out, mm-hmm. outside.
Okay. Well, the reason we're talking about tomatoes isn't just because you grow them. It's everyone's favorite fruit, vegetable, whatever, and they want to grow it and they want to eat it. They want to have it fresh. And no matter whether you say it's stupid to grow them outside or not, people will do it.
I'm not going to say it's stupid because it's it's in everybody's experiment.
Right.
There's some really hot gossip out there in the tomato world that I've been chasing down. And I have to say, I've kind of scoffed at this. You brought it up in previous radio shows about grafted tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
but apparently this grafting tomatoes onto
a hardy root system
that, it's that you have roots, you have plants or gene stocks that have fantastic root systems, but the tomatoes come see, come saw.
Right.
But, but they're I guess, incredibly graftable. Just like you do with fruit,
but
grafts.
It, I mean, the pictures that you see in the seed catalogs of the grafted tomatoes next to their non-grafted twins.
I know.
It's like, you know, it's like, duh, of course you'd buy it. But we had no better. We bought a bunch of graphs the year before, and they weren't, they did not produce any appreciably better than the other ones.
So, really?
Yes. Yeah, so you've had a different experience, or the gossip is that it's awesome?
I've been hearing the gossip, and so I think I'm going to get off my little high horse and try practicing.
Oh, you haven't tried it?
On grafting. No, it intimidates the hell out of me. Can I say? I don't know.
To do?
But I don't know.
To do it?
To graft, yeah. I mean, it's...
Oh, grafting. Grafting is easy.
Oh, you make it... Oh, okay. Yeah, so you're all confident about it then.
Well, but see, we didn't do our own grafts. We paid big money for somebody else to do the graft.
What was it, Johnny's or Territorial?
Territorial. But okay. Barry grafts on all our fruit trees all the time, and he's very confident with that. Well, what would be the difference?
That's, you know, I've watched guys graft fruit trees, and they just make it look so easy. And
well, it is.
You know, yeah, and so is, you know, using a French knife after you've done it a lot. Otherwise, you can cut the bejesus out of yourself.
But, you know, if you've got 200 tomatoes that you're looking at possibly grafting, so you have a few disasters. So what?
And that's it. That's kind of where I'm going to be looking at this year. Is I'm gonna be getting some of this rootstock, and I'm gonna grow rootstock.
So from seed,
and
preferred
tomatoes.
Seed?
I believe so. Uh-huh. It's all very new to me, and I'm kind of going
what,
in. Kicking
what variety
and screaming.
Would be a good
of the rootstock?
Yeah.
You know, these are the names that are like B27A.
Uh-huh.
B27A hybrid. Is a fantastic rootstock.
Oh.
I'm lying. I don't know that.
Oh, okay. I won't write that down.
But I will be researching it.
Uh-huh.
And I think I encourage, you know, people in the listening audience, there mm-hmm. are rootstock tomatoes out there. Principally, I've seen them in Johnny's. But I'm going to be mm-hmm. doing research on this, and I'll keep you... keep you updated, because I went with Carol and George Carver yesterday to a farmer from Quebec that's growing tomatoes, and he's growing them consistently year after year in the same greenhouse. And, you know, the story is that you develop pathogens and stuff in your soils, and you have to rotate your tomatoes out. Which is tough when you're looking at your greenhouse costing, you know, $8,000 to $12,000. You don't have just,
you can't
we'll just
build another
greenhouse
one, right.
to rotate this one out onto. And he's been able to deal with a lot of those disease issues with grafted tomatoes. And I thought I was a pretty good tomato grower. And this guy's smoking me. I mean, this is like, he and his wife are doing amazing things. I mean, it's really encouraging. It's really challenging, but it's encouraging.
And he's doing grafting?
He's doing grafting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you look at, I mean, Quebec is like, they've got a much later springtime than we do.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, they've got, look at Boston right now, you know, it's like they've got feet of snow on the ground.
But
so.
If you can afford the electricity or the gas to keep your greenhouse warm, it doesn't really matter what it is outside.
Yeah, or just make a grow room out of that spare bedroom in the house.
Yeah, you have one of those.
Oh my gosh, yes. It's scandalous.
All right, so I want to talk about, so let's say your tomatoes that you're not grafting, do you have like five favorite varieties?
I have, you know, I find that I've been able to grow a lot of different tomatoes, okay. But at the same time, you grow them for market. So you have to have a matching consumer at the other end of it.
Right, people.
That wants that.
Okay.
You know, and so I've grown a lot of heirlooms. Mm-hmm. And I've had complaints, you know, the market likes some tomatoes more than others. Cherry tomatoes kind of sell themselves. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge amount of flavor.
But there are so many varieties of cherries. I mean, there are the grape ones and the pear ones and the yellow ones and the orange ones and the purple.
And they all have
purple.
Different flavor profiles,
so
each and every one of them.
Do you have favorites?
You know, on the cherry department, yeah, any of the sweet 100s, there's both golden and there is, I didn't bring a list of my favorite tomatoes, but, you know, with an early salad tomato in the Northwest that OSU, through their development of, well, initially the early girl,
mm-hmm.
and now I think they've come up with more of a new girl, mm-hmm. different seed strains, that's a very competent tomato,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it's a great salad tomato. As far as a slicer goes, you know, you've got, oh, geez, big beef. You've got just a whole.
How about Brandywine?
Brandywine is an heirloom, which I love Brandywine, but I've had some issues with Blossom End Rot with them.
Oh, so have we.
And so, and you know what I found out was fascinating is because they say Blossom End Rot is because you don't have enough calcium in your soil.
Right.
So I thought, well, I've had my soil tested. I've got calcium in the soil. What the heck's the problem?
Because the other tomatoes don't have it.
Get this. It's like when you've got really hot days, one, you can sunburn your tomatoes, which I find that completely non-rational, but they can get sunburned.
Uh-huh.
But you can have temperatures that as the temperatures go up, the tomatoes respirate. Or, well, I don't know, respirate is probably not the right word, but they draw moisture up their stems to their fruit. And if it's too much of a temperature imbalance, that if it's too hot, they can't get the nutrition to the fruit rapidly enough. And I'm still figuring this out. I hope I don't sound like a complete bozo, but it's basically about temperature variations. You really want to keep your fruit between about 75 and 85 degrees is your sweet spot.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you've got over 85 degrees, you're treading on dangerous water. And in a greenhouse, it's very easy to turn it into a solar oven, man.
We had a 95 day in the greenhouse last week.
And that's stress. Yep, that's going to stress
the
plants.
But all that's in there now are tomatoes and orchids. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more. We've got somebody with some questions, and we'll talk about what's happening with the small farmer in the country. You're listening to Digging the Dirt. Back, you're listening to Digging the Dirt. I'm with Fred Johnson, a farmer from Nacelle, Washington, and we're talking about growing tomatoes. Okay, so we had someone who thought maybe a Brandywine is too long of a season for here, but no. If you were growing it outside.
That's the thing of that when I first was trying to do tomatoes, I was struggling and failing because I didn't have a greenhouse. I didn't have a way to mm-hmm. extend the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
That being that you
started
earlier.
Well, also making it warm enough.
Making it
warm
enough.
We don't have enough therms here.
Well, I mean, you can crank it up with a greenhouse.
Well, I mean, outside in the yard, you're never going to have enough heat to make a great tasting tomato.
Yeah, that's a struggle like with peppers at the same time. You know, you can grow peppers, but trying to get them to ripen and turn red, you're going to be working well into September. At least my experience is that it's tough to get. I'm not banking on a red marketable pepper.
Right.
And with tomatoes, you know, you're definitely just going to shorten their production, I think, leaving them outside. It's one of those things that they really do need to be babied.
But, you know, if you have a small garden and you have beds and you can put some kind of plastic over it, you can definitely extend the season and warm it up a lot. And then remember that in the hot of the day to take off the plastic because it's going to be
guarding
just like in a greenhouse.
Those nighttime colds. I think that is my best efforts is when I can protect them at night. It's kind of closing the greenhouses at the. There's days in August where I don't roll down the sides of my greenhouse, but if it's getting chilly, you know, I think it confuses the tomato plant. There's like, what the heck, man?
We want it to be warm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where's the warmth?
So the other question was about short season recommendations. And so those are, I mean, I would start with anything small.
Well, you know, I'd say that the most confident tomato I know right off the bat for a tomato flavored, a homegrown tomato, invest in cherry tomatoes. That's the old grandmother vine. You know that's the oldest. That's where we've derived all the other varieties of tomatoes is from cherries. They're tough as heck. They're delicious in flavor. I mean, for ounce, you get more flavor out of a cherry tomato than just about any other tomato.
Okay. The other question was about for sauce.
For sauce tomatoes, you're looking more at a plum tomato with those.
Okay.
Like an Italian type
plum. And there are
lots
of plums that are really easy to grow.
I mean, you can make sauce out of anything, but, you know, traditionally plum tomatoes are more of a sauce tomato.
Okay. Then we have another caller who wants to know about clear plastic better than opaque for tomatoes? Does it make a difference?
Clear plastic as opposed to opaque?
Yeah.
I don't understand the question.
The opaque meaning that sort of filmy, kind of whitish, where you it's not quite see-through.
You know, proper greenhouse plastic is a great investment. If you're going to build a greenhouse, wrap it in real greenhouse plastic because it's designed, it's UV tolerant. You're going to get a much longer shelf life. It's like sounds like the opaque plastic is something that's had a lot. It's not made for UV protection. So it's like it'll turn opaque rather quickly exposed to sunlight. So, you know, this is one place, Oregon Valley Greenhouse, call there and bother Ivan. He knows all about greenhouse plastics.
What if you're just setting up like a cloche? You've got a bed and or even just a plant and you're going to cover it. Clear plastic versus something else.
Yeah.
No difference?
I mean, versus something else like glass, well, you think? Or?
No. Like a milk bottle that's whatever, you know, that kind of...
Oh, to protect it?
Well, yeah. A milk bottle versus like putting some kind of clear plastic on top.
Well, you know, I can't say conclusively about that, but uh-huh. I would... What I have of a logical brain would say... The more light transmission you have, the better and happier that plant's going to be.
So clear is going to be better.
So it's like, yep,
glass
it's like the
is
more
gonna be better
the
than
more spectrum you
plastic.
Can get. You know, it's like you look at any kind of greenhouse lighting, mm-hmm. the wider the spectrum,
uh-huh. so
the better it's going to be. Now that's a huge generality, and you know, it's a generality. But
okay, all right. So let's change gears a little bit. I read an article that you forwarded me by Jacqueline Moyer, who's a writer, and she went around and talked to lots and lots of small farmers and did a bunch of research. And what she writes about is horrible, that 90% of small farmers are not making it, and that they are only surviving because of off-the-farm income, which is your reality as well.
Yep, that's about anybody's reality.
And I think that we have more, and at the same time, more and more people want to farm. More and more people want that. There's a romantic notion in the United States that living on a farm would be better. I don't know even what it is because I have the same romantic idea. And people look at someone like you who has the farm and they are envious and they have no idea what the
They're
struggles are.
They're not envious of that monthly note, though.
Yeah, but they don't know about that. And we expect the small farmer to be there for us and to provide us with fresh produce when we want it. And yet, there's not the political and the financial structure to make it feasible.
Financially feasible. Yep.
Right.
That's our big, that's the big challenge now of that there has to be, it's interesting. There has to be a balancing system, you know, for the amount of work being put out by small farmers, there has to be some kind of reciprocation in the form of cash.
Well, the bizarre thing is all the money,
very thin.
All the money for supporting agriculture is for a large agribusiness.
That's, yeah.
And what we really need is a redistribution to help all small local farmers.
We need, you just say it, socialism. We need
all right.
Socialism.
Well, yeah, well, they we have it, and it only helps the small...
I mean, well, I'm not really joking, but...
Well, no, but it's not just. It is not a just system. It penalizes entrepreneurs and small people,
you know,
and it rewards multimillionaires and billionaires.
It's funny, when I was chefing professionally, my goal was to get beautiful, lovely produce at rock bottom prices, which, you know, you look at it, it's like those are mutually exclusive things. And it was magical thinking on my part. You know, it's like I would find produce, I could find a farmer, and then I wanted to just get it at the lowest possible price for my own self-interest. Because
well,
me as a restaurateur, you know, it's like, it's basically you're buying low, you're processing the goods, and then you're retailing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my margins of profitability were based on me being able to get those, that above average produce at below, well, or at wholesale prices,
right.
essentially. And
mm-hmm.
and I was failing at it. The only farmers that I could find were exclusively going to a retail market. and capturing, you know, direct to the customer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This has been an incredibly important part of my farming experience was with the CSA, you know, in the CSA model where people are paying essentially a retail price and then they're front loading they're putting their dollars mm-hmm. at the head of the season, as opposed to where, so the farmer is not the, you know, farmers have to carry all the risk, all the venture. It's a lot of money. That's what I'm dealing with now.
You work year round, you know, you're doing your soil amendments, you have to buy equipment, you have to fix equipment, you have to buy your seeds.
Yep.
Yeah, you have to do all the things year round, and then hopefully, well, I mean, then the day that the strawberries are ripe, you know, some critter comes in and eats them all, and you can't sell anything.
Or, I mean, or you get undercut by another farmer, or a larger, more established or financially secure farmer. I mean, that's right. Happened to
or something being imported.
A big potato grower here in our region. You know, it's that it's a treacherous place. Right. You know, and it's tough. And
do you have any? I from that article, I didn't really see a solution. I mean, I see that she laid out a great.
She kind of defined the problem.
She defined the problem, right? And what I think we need to look at is a lot of us are involved with CSAs, involved with local farm. You know, frequent restaurants that buy local produce and, you know, local fish, and we're really value all that local, and yet the farmers are going out of business. So I think that we need to sort to take our dollars, right, the collective people mm-hmm. that care about this, to the political machine to change the subsidies so that they're not all going to agribusiness, so that they're getting distributed throughout
that's
the country.
You know, that is a definite approach. I mean,
okay.
I think.
Do you have another one? Give me another one.
What I guess I'm looking at now is that I'm in going over my costs for this last season. I'm finding that as a farmer, I'm operating at about a 20-25% loss, and I'm having the really tough conversation with myself is that I simply don't have the financial wherewithal to continue that, and so until I can come up with a better system that I can at least break even or secure. A very, very moderate profit to reinvest into the business, reinvest into the farm, that I need to go back to the drawing board. I need mm-hmm. to study more. Mm-hmm. And the solution, though, it's tantalizing because I feel like all the elements of the solution are right here in front of us. We have a vibrant consumer base.
Absolutely.
That want to support this. I mean, mm-hmm. the latest... studies that the co-op was doing, the Astoria mm-hmm. co-op, is that people want local produce.
Absolutely.
But I think we really have to start a conversation and a really involved conversation with ourselves as a community and following those mechanisms. Zeddy Nemowil did a really nice presentation at the brews and I forget the name. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was talking about local agriculture and what we can do. But we've got to have a conversation of how do we make this hold water? How do we invest our consumer dollar mm-hmm. locally mm-hmm. in a secure and fruitful manner? You know, we need the same efforts that we have to go to get a tomato that delivers produce. It's all that babying. Farmers and farm systems are really no different. You have to grow them. You know, it's. Mm-hmm. I've tried demanding tomatoes from my tomato plants, and they have nothing
you.
For it.
Yeah. Okay, so another idea Small occurs to me. Buggers. If all of the little farms, if all the little farmers unionize or join together in some kind of a large, right?
Yeah, farmers are crusty. They're a crusty bunch.
I know, but if they join together, they may be able to exert some political influence.
Well, you know, Friends of Family Farmers, I was at the conference yesterday, Friends of Family Farmers are going to be doing, what is it? They're going to the state capitol and starting to work on exactly the things you were talking about, the legislative end. Of these things. I wish I had more information on that. I don't, but if you go or Google Friends of Family Farmers, a fantastic organization.
So it sounds like there are things going on to try to aggregate farmers together to have a bigger voice to try to protect small family farms.
Well, and hopefully to empower consumers to really learn how and develop means of, it's your consumer dollar that's mm-hmm. going to float this solution. I mean, honest to gosh, it's like no part of this system can do it by themselves. Farmers aren't going to solve this on their own. Consumers won't solve it on their own. And retailers, all the restaurants, the people, it's a food system, mm-hmm. you know, and it's
takes the whole system.
It takes the whole system and it takes strong coordination. And that's definitely a learning curve for our communities, mm-hmm. but it's something that I think that is where the solution lies.
I agree. You're listening to Digging the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldine.